Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for October 26, 2023, going down the home stretch of this year. Many topics to cover tonight. First of all, a tribute to a man that passed away a number of years ago. I'm not sure how many, maybe 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'm not quite sure, but his name is Brad Walton. He was a good friend of mine, and I did many, many interviews with Brad. He was a nationally recognized talk show host, and it was interesting because there would be times when I would pre-record a show with Brad, and he was on, like, late night. He had a radio show that aired out of, I think it was KSTP, radio, one of the very old radio stations, AM stations. And so anyway, Brad had a show that aired, I think it was like 11 at night to midnight or 2 in the morning. And some of these interviews were 2 hours. Like he interviewed me, for example, for my prime number book. And he was very interested in my work, all aspects of it. But he would read the books and study it before he did the interview. So he was really well-versed, and there were times when I'd be on his show, and then I'd be live, because we pre-recorded the show. He was gracious enough to pre-record a show, and then I would be live on Coast to Coast AM, so on pretty much all the other channels. So his show would be multicasted through many other radio stations that didn't have talk shows on at that time of night, but they wanted to carry some content. So they would take and simulcast Brad's show. And, of course, Coast to Coast AM had, what, 600, 700 affiliate radio stations broadcasting there. So I would be on two full shows at the same time in the country. And people would call up and they'd say, "Why? Every time I turn on the radio, you're on there." You know, anyway, it was interesting. But Brad was a really amazing person. He was very interested in nature and conservation, and, like I say, very interested in my work. But unfortunately, he passed away, and so we don't have that great talent here anymore, that ability to recognize things and their importance in the world, importance for you. So, anyway, wish that Brad were still around with us, but that is not the case. So, a tribute to Brad Walton. And if you look on, for example, my university-level course that I have on my webpage, I have some of Brad's interviews of me. And we talk about various topics. And like I say, he would read my books, study it. And so when he did an interview, he was not just a guy, taking a mild interest. He was very involved in it also. So let's see. I wanted to talk about Lake Titicaca. These are the topics I'll be covering tonight. Lake Titicaca, which I visited somewhat recently, and Peru, it's on the border between Peru and Bolivia. And there's a city at the bottom of this lake, this extremely cold, it's the highest lake in the world, and it's a big lake. It's a big, big lake. I mean, this is not just a puddle of water. And at the bottom, there is a remnants of an ancient city. So ask me where that came from. Okay, well, I'll be talking about that. I'll be talking a little bit about giants. And then a lot about the Chinese space program. This is mind-boggling what is going on with the Chinese space program. So I'll be talking about that. And then just also remind you that I have the best water filters on the planet. And when you see these products, I mean, you could take, and at Christmas dinner with a full entourage of guests over, you could take the stainless steel containers and put them in the middle of your dining room table, and they would be appropriate. That's how beautifully finished these are. Stainless steel containers, the MR5 water filter, the stainless steel sink filter, the 36-inch ultraviolet filter, the PFAS filter, which is a certified PFAS filter. It's NSF certified to remove PFAS chemicals or forever chemicals, but absolutely gorgeous products. And at a price, I mean, and when I look around, I had some people call me again this week, and they were shopping for water filters. One of the companies, I'm not going to say the name, is probably one that you've heard about. They sell water softeners, and they're trying to fleece these people. That's the only word I can use, sorry, for over $6,000 to install a water softener in their house, calling it a whole house water filter. And it's a plastic tank. And I'm like, oh my goodness. And they're in business, so I mean, this company's in business. So that would indicate that they're selling this stuff and people are buying it and they're getting people to pay this kind of money. In my stainless steel unit, where you get the MR5, the ultraviolet filter, and the extra set of filter elements for like $2,300, and you look at the quality of the stainless steel container, I mean, it's just amazing quality. At a low price, and is a true broad spectrum water filter. It is a filter, not a water softener. And by the way, how do you tell a water softener? The water softener is a single tank. It's sometimes a wound fiber plastic tank, or it might be literally a plastic tank. And it comes up to the top, and it has a single small, kind of like a funnel hole at the top, a single connector at the top, and sometimes it has a meter-like units screwed onto it, and then the water comes in and comes out that same hole. That's a water softener. So please don't be fooled. Somebody's trying to sell you that as a water filter. It's not. There's nothing filter about it. It's not. It doesn't have any real filtration. You send the water down through it's like sand made of different materials, and it can remove certain chemicals, but like one or two, not thousands of them. Anyway, enough of that. On to a couple other quick stories from the engineering world here. There is a group of scientists. They're from the University of Surrey and Swansea in England, and they've been working on understanding the effects of solar panels in outer space. So what they want to do, and it's really kind of hokey, they have the picture of this satellite with solar panels on it, collecting solar energy, turning it into electricity, and then they're beaming it down to Earth, where it would then be apparently used for electricity. And let me tell you something, in a clear, say, Arizona, where you have very clear skies, and probably one of the better places on the planet for solar panels, solar panels are not very good. They're only about 20% efficient at converting the energy in the sunlight into electricity. But even at that, to provide the kind of electricity that we need for our industrialized society, we're talking huge, huge amounts of energy. So you would have to pave the heavens with solar panels to get enough energy to beam it down, Scotty, to Earth, and with enough energy to be useful. However, the problem is, and here's, again, these people simply don't understand that you cannot beam energy down through the atmosphere because it will break down the vertical electric field and it'll cause a lot of damage. Not to mention that it'll kill a lot of birds and animals. So what they're finding with, for example, solar panels is that they kill a lot of birds that fly over them because of the amount of heat a solar panel absorbs, about 20% of the heat that is converted to electricity. That other 80% of the sunlight then turns into radiant energy and goes up. So birds flying over it, that heat just basically fries them, bakes them or whatever, and kills them. So there's the, and then you have the three-blade wind turbines that are killing birds by the millions, and there's big birds, eagles, etc. They get a dispensation from killing eagles. Can you imagine that? That, oh my goodness. If you went out and killed an eagle, they'd have you in prison. No, but three-blade wind turbines, they're allowed to kill birds. And within, you know, they put them in these windy passes that are also where the birds happen to fly in their transition between winter and summertime, going north and south. But wait till they start beaming down immense amounts of energy from outer space through the atmosphere down to ground, and they're just going to be killing vast amounts of birds. So it's just absolute insanity. But of course, the people that live in these ivory towers, the University of Surrey and Swansea, is that how you say it? The people in England. But now, here's the other thing. As I always say, if it isn't going to work, if it's a boondoggle, if it has no chance of reaching up and actually competing with existing electrical power or any other power source, then it gets funded. Then it gets notoriety. It gets published. It gets headlines. And it takes years. This particular study they've been doing for 6 years already, and concentrating on the feasibility of solar panels in outer space and their survivability in outer space and in the harsh environment of the sun that's outside of the atmosphere, because our atmosphere takes out X-rays, it takes out a lot of ultraviolet. The amount of damaging radiation that gets down to us is really, a lot of that is filtered out by the upper atmosphere. But in outer space, you don't have that. So a solar panel out there on its own is going to be just basically open to the environment of outer space and the sun. And so what they were studying, that's the aspect of their study, which, okay, that's maybe okay. But then to imagine that you then extrapolate this and imagine that you can beam this energy down to Earth, there are other projects that are doing similar things. One is the elevator, the space elevator, where they pretend that they're going to take a cable, anchor it to Earth. You put a big cement structure, you put bolts way down in the Earth, and then you run a tether, which is a cord, up in out of the atmosphere and to a, like, maybe they're talking about an asteroid-sized object that then is put in orbit around the Earth, and it just sits there, and this, then you ride up the cable up to this tethered asteroid, you ride up like an elevator. Well, it isn't going to work because, number one, it's going to discharge the vertical electric field, which is going to cause all kinds of havoc with the weather system, with the energy coming down from the ionosphere, etc. And then, besides that, it's physically not going to work, because just getting up into orbit by going vertically, what happens? And this is, you have to understand a little bit about physics and rotational dynamics, that if you, as we're standing on Earth, you don't notice this, but if you tried to, say, build an infinite ladder and climb up that ladder, okay, you're going upwards, but your rotational velocity around Earth, you're trying to keep the same angular velocity, which is moving through the same angle for a given period of time. But what happens is, because of energy conservation, you cannot get something for nothing. And that's what these, it's like the perpetual motion machine. Okay, so you cannot go up what's going to happen is you're going to be forced backwards, because excuse me, let me explain it this way. If you are, let's say you're in orbit around the Earth, you're in orbit around the Earth. If you want to go into a higher orbit, then you have to accelerate in the perpendicular to the radial direction. The radial direction is outwards from the center of the Earth, and you have to accelerate perpendicular to that, and that makes you go into a higher orbit. If you want to slow down and go into a lower orbit, you turn your thrusters around and you push against your direction of motion and you fall into a lower orbit. And what you're doing there is you're changing your kinetic energy. Now, imagine you're going up this cable and you're going into higher and higher orbits, which takes more and more energy, but you're not providing more and more energy in the direction perpendicular to the vertical cable. So you're not able to get this for free. And then that's where people are just like they're really so stupid. This is physics 101, basically, or maybe 102, possibly, rotational dynamics. But you have physicists who really don't understand basic physics. So a tethered asteroid space elevator simply will not work. So I hope I get my voice. I hope I can last to the end of this show. I'm kind of losing it a little bit. Okay, so the solar panel in outer space. Now there's other ways to gather energy in outer space, like a focusing it on like a Stirling engine. A Stirling engine is one where you heat up water in a container. It turns into steam. That steam then drives a rotor of some kind. And then when that energy is lost, the water turns back to, the steam turns back to water, and this cycle goes on. But the energy you're using comes from the sun. You're focusing on this Stirling engine device, and they have these, for example, out in the southwestern desert. There was a big project, I believe it's now defunct, where they've invested a lot of money in mirrors, and then all the mirrors shined up to this tower. Kind of like the Lord of the Rings kind of tower where all his energy is focused, and it had a Stirling engine and they were going to produce electricity. The problem in outer space then is what do you do with the electricity? Down on the ground, they would hook it up to the grid and, feed the electricity into the grid. But in outer space, there again, you got to beam this energy down. And once again, you would discharge, you would create an electrical discharge in the vertical electric field of Earth, which none of these idiots know about. Let's go back to Ben Franklin. Here's a guy out there, he wanted to experiment with electricity, so he puts a key on a kite in a thunderstorm. And lets it go up in the air, and he's got a little key on there. Well, that little key is enough to discharge enough of the vertical electric field so that it causes a lightning bolt to come down the string and just about kills Ben Franklin. And so anyway, this is because there's a vertical electric field. That's what Tesla was working with. He was working with the Wardenclyffe Tower, and then out in Colorado Springs with some other versions of towers where he was collecting atmospheric electricity. And he understood these principles, but he was going to convert that vertical electric field energy into electricity and then distribute it underground. That was his project. And of course, as soon as the J.P. Morgan and the boys found out about this, they came in and tore down his experiment because it would compete with their energy monopoly. Okay, so anyway, the idea of putting something in space or having space elevators run all of them run into the same problem that you would discharge the vertical electric field and cause havoc, chaos, and mayhem on planet Earth down here, where and kill a lot of birds. Oh, just absolute idiocy. Here's a little tip. Get rid of extra stuff. Now, excuse me. I'm on John Moore's show every Wednesday morning, as a lot of you probably know. And he always has this prepper tip of the day. And so anyway, I added my own, Wednesday morning, to get rid of extra stuff. If you haven't used stuff in a while, then probably you're not going to use it. And so having all this clutter around, especially if it's in your living area, is a real issue psychologically, because it confuses people. It's just very confusing to have all of this stuff like sitting around, or like sometimes little kids' bedrooms, they put all these little stuffed animals on shelves and stuff like that. It's really not good. A very simple environment where you don't have much at all visible is the most calming environment. I wanted to talk about Lake Titicaca, which, like I say, I'd recently visited. And this is on the border between Peru and Bolivia. So it's up in the mountains. It's the highest lake in the world. And it's a big lake. It's a very big lake, a very beautiful big lake. And there are people that live out there that still make the reed boats. And, of course, that's part of the Kon-Tiki expedition Thor Heyerdahl, where he connects the boat builders of Lake Titicaca with the Polynesians coming over and settling. And so anyway, that's a very good, if you have a chance, Kon-Tiki, I believe is the name of the book. And there's another book that's related to where he studies Easter Island, one of the very first people to really take or bring out to the public, I should say, the statues on Easter Island. And that book was called Aku Aku. I read these when I was in high school. I read them during the summertime, and actually got to see Thor Heyerdahl live when I was a young person and living in Mexico City. He came there as a fundraiser for one of his upcoming projects, so I went to see him. And a very dynamic speaker, and of course, adventurer, going out and funding his own anthropology and archaeological projects. Okay, so back up to Lake Titicaca. At the bottom of the lake is a major ruin of a city. Like Mayans, like the Aztecs, like the Peruvians. And so how did this city get down into the bottom of the lake? Well, clearly something had to have happened. And of course, this is probably related to one of the major events that we know happened on planet Earth going back, in some cases, tens of thousands of years. The history of man goes way back, and there were many natural disasters, and this level of disaster could only be fomented by something big coming by in the solar system. The Earth doesn't just jump up and raise mountains up by tens of thousands of feet and all its mass, etc. This doesn't just happen on its own. It's not plate tectonics like you read about in the modern textbooks. The only way this can happen is by a gravitational wave of a large passing object. And so this city at the bottom of Lake Titicaca had to have been, they really don't know anything about it. It was explored, I think, with National Geographic and Jacques Cousteau, if I'm not mistaken. I believe that's what they were saying there, the sometimes difficult to understand. because they're speaking somewhat native dialects, not really true Spanish. They did go there and dive on these structures and looking at them. Now, the standard belief is that this was built before the water was in the lake, and then somehow the lake level rose above them. But since we have many structures all over the world that are underwater, many of them in the ocean, and let's put it this way, there were times, there were epochs in Earth's history, these catastrophic events that raised ocean levels and lake levels. One of them was the Noah's Flood, and once again, a large passing comet. There's no other explanation for this tremendous influx of water that just flooded the entire earth with rain that came from above. But there's the other events that followed the thousands of years later was the Venus event, what I also call the Moses event, that actually changed because of the gravity waves of the large passing comet Venus. They actually changed the levels of land, some things going under, some things going up. And so the city that's under Lake Titicaca, what makes more sense is that it was at a lower point, it's a certain point in time, and that this was a civilization that existed at a different level, at a different altitude, right, with respect to sea level. I'm talking about altitude above sea level. And so, of course, we don't know. There's no real way of understanding what may have happened there. But the Earth has had some very amazing... As people will ask me and they'll say, what kind of earthquake on a Richter scale would you compare this to? And, of course, the Richter scale is a logarithmic. In other words, as you go from, say, a 4 on the Richter scale to 5, that's a power of 10. And so a 5 earthquake would be 10 times more powerful than a 4. And a 4 would be 10 times more powerful than a 3. And so a 5 would be 100 times more powerful than a 3. If you go two layers from a 2 to a 3 to a 4, or from a 3 to a 5, as I was saying, then that's a change of 100 in the level of energy in the earthquake. So the people will ask me, you know, and of course we're familiar with 8 and 9 on the Richter scale earthquakes that are extremely damaging, probably not much makes it through without being, you know, buildings in terms of structures, man-made structures, that they will just come tumbling down with an 8 or a 9 on the Richter scale. And so what I said in response is that a passing comet like Venus would be on the Richter scale maybe a 20. So that would be maybe 10 orders of magnitude larger than the largest earthquake that has ever happened on planet Earth independently. Just tremendous damage. And so you'll find places also in Peru where the structures are simply destroyed. And there's no logical explanation for that. There's no reason why these massive stone structures would just simply fall apart like that. And given, you know, a stable Earth, they would last. They would last tens of thousands of years, maybe with a little bit of weathering. But anyway, back to Lake Titicaca and the ruins. There are other ruins in the area. They say that this underwater ruin also has a road that was built similar to other roads in the Inca Empire area. And this road, they found, was underneath the water near this site that's there. Okay, so very interesting archaeology, something that I wish I had more time to pursue. And someday I believe I will get back to doing some serious archaeology. There are so many places around the world that really need good archaeological work. The Amazon jungle is ripe with it. Just so many other places, not the least of which would be Central and South America, the countries like Peru or Bolivia, where there's a tremendous history, and then north of Peru, where the Incas lived, but then also the prior civilizations that were there before the Incas. For example, the Incas said that they were not part and parcel to the Nazca lines, that those were due to previous civilizations that they really didn't know about. You can see my paper on the Nazca lines, where I discovered what the true meaning of them is all about. And so go to my webpage, the jmccsci.com webpage, and that's the short URL. Once again, jmccsci.com, and look for that white paper on the Nazca lines. Very interesting. I really would like to get back to some of the things that I used to do, but it seems like there's an old expression: the faster I run, the farther behind I get. And the that's kind of it seems like true of me at least lately. Just been working harder and harder, but it's all good because I'm helping a lot of people, like with the water filters. I'm helping people get clean water, and I often say that if I worked at McDonald's hamburger stand, I'd probably make more money per unit hour that I spend, because I spend a lot of time organizing, and but the end result is helping people. For example, this was something that happened maybe a year or so ago. I got a call from a couple, elderly couple. They were from, I think it was Michigan or someplace like that. But anyway, they had been saving. They were just very ecstatic. They had been saving their money to buy a four pack of filter elements from me. These are the gravity water filter elements. And they were going to buy the four pack, which is $189. And most of us wouldn't really flinch too much at spending $189 where to have years of clean water. But this couple was saving money to buy a four pack of my gravity filter replacement filter elements for the stainless steel water filter. And so it just shows you kind of the condition of people out there. Okay, this next story is very interesting. For weeks I've been talking about the Jupiter winds and what happened this past week. A horrific storm hit Acapulco, the southwestern Mexican coastline there. I remember as a young person driving down to Acapulco and then driving south, and this is when things were still relatively wild there, not the level of tourism that you find today. But anyway, I would in my vehicle drive south out of Acapulco, and I can still remember the banana plantations and the coconut plantations. And I remember also stopping at a place to eat fish that was fresh out of the ocean. Just amazing, just amazing food. And they would cook it for you also. These great big fish, or other types of seafood. But Acapulco just recently devastated by a hurricane, a Category 5 hurricane named Otis. Now, the Jupiter winds, I defined this term back in the 1990s, and what it amounts to is the electrical discharge that Earth has with the solar capacitor. And if you're not familiar with my work, then you have to. I'm not going to repeat all of that on the air, but the Earth, all of the planets are discharging the solar capacitor. Jupiter much more than any of the others, and Earth has a fairly significant discharge, very incorrectly called a magnetic magnetic tail is what standard science calls it, but it's not a magnetic tail, it's an electrical tail, and because of the currents you end up with a magnetic flux, which is measurable. And so that's, now again, that is not the explanation, the true explanation of what's going on there. But Jupiter's electrical discharge and Earth's electrical discharge align approximately every 13 months. Earth goes around in its orbit, and by the time it gets around to the same place, Jupiter has moved ahead in its orbit, so we have to go a bit farther to pick up that electrical alignment. But the main result of the Jupiter winds, as I call them, would be straight line winds that can, you know, typically they're not going to kill you unless a piece of roofing off of somebody's house or something hits you in the head. But the straight line winds can be 20, 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, and one of the characteristics is that they are there for just days and days. They're persistent. They just don't end. And so people trying to weather the storm, and it gives you an idea of what's going on and what's driving this. In the case of Acapulco, this hurricane, because this is, now we're almost to the end of the hurricane season. That doesn't mean it wouldn't happen. But there again, this is a highly unusual storm for this time of year. But it's a related to the connection, the electrical connection that Earth is having with Jupiter that's going on right now. It's hitting its peak. This hurricane may have occurred in a time without the Jupiter winds, but it wouldn't have been a Category 5. It would have maybe been a Category 2 storm. So anyway, hope the people in Acapulco are able to recover quickly. But winds like this, Category 5 level winds, are going to destroy a lot of infrastructure, a lot of roads, and a lot of the secondary housing and third level housing that's out where just the average people live. They just, these kind of winds are extremely damaging to the average house. Typically on this show, I stay away from political issues, etc., but this situation in the Mideast where it's just accelerating, and countries like the United States, when they say, okay, they're going to give huge amounts of aid, and they're siding with one country being Israel, you have to look at the human populations, the civilian populations in these areas. And to not go in with a ceasefire agreement is insanity. I mean, the United States should be brokering a peace agreement and say, okay, look, whatever's going on here, we got to fix it and come to an agreement. But this, you know, just wholesale shelling and killing innocent people as part of this, you know, however it started, it's one of those things that no matter how it started, this cannot go on. China has a fleet of ships there that would be against the United States. The various other Arab countries are taking sides with Palestine, the Palestine country, which is mainly civilians. And also you have to understand that the Hamas terrorist group is really not, in the truest sense of the word, it's really not representative of Palestine or the people that live there especially. But anyway, the whole point is that there has to be a movement for a ceasefire, just stop the shooting. And then, okay, let things calm down, and then we're going to try to settle differences. But this is starting to turn into a giant mess. It really has been a giant mess for a long time. But what's going on with the what I believe is going on, I've said this before, is they're just trying to clear out this region and then turn it into some kind of a tourist mecca because of the history that's there. That you would need a very large area to build hotels, and there's plenty of land in that area of the world to expand, to have hotels. And Egypt and other countries have developments that are going on out in the middle of the desert. There's plenty of land, it just doesn't happen to be where these people want it. So anyway, just insanity where a major broker in the world like the United States should be moving with a ceasefire agreement. It should have happened right away, saying, okay, stop the shooting. And the United Nations could also be in there with troops, although they're from what it seems, both sides are killing UN troops that are in there. Absolute insanity. But the United Nations has not been effective for a very, very long time, going back to when I was young. So that's a real long time ago, and not being effective at stopping conflict, which is their main charter. That's what they're supposed to be doing. Okay, and like I say, that's not political, it's not Republican, it's not Democrat, it's just common sense to stop this thing, stop this conflict, because there's nobody that's going to win this war. There might be someone who claims to be a victor, but already every side has lost. There are no winners in a war. To say that somebody won a war is a oxymoron. It doesn't make any sense. There are no winners in war. Talking about giants a little bit, if you're not aware, there have been, or there's vast evidence that the world had races of giants. And I'm not talking about, comic book style reporting. I'm talking about serious archaeological evidence. Magellan, when he came around Tierra del Fuego, ran into a whole colony of giants living there. He took one on his ship with him, and of course, on a normal sized ship for normal sized people, a giant simply wouldn't have the food or the ability to prosper there. So that giant died. And also, Magellan brought back a femur from one of the giants that was in that area. And so, of course, obviously a skeleton, but that femur is allegedly in the Vatican and somewhere in the catacomb archives of the Vatican. So anyway, I was on John Moore's show, and he was mentioning this, and mentioned a book by Steve Quayle, a friend of mine, called Empire Beneath the Ice. Anyway, talking about the Antarctica regions and the explorations there. Okay, so I want to spend the rest of this show talking about the Chinese space program, which is mind-boggling. Just to give you a little bit of history, of course, the U.S. space program actually began in World War II with the German rocketry, the V-1, the V-2s, and other larger rockets that they were starting to build. The ability to use liquid fuel engines, where the fuel, as it expanded from a liquid form, cooled the cones on the engine and allowed them very, very high temperature burn on the fuel. And so this eventually became the basis, with Wernher von Braun heading the German rocket scientists being brought to the United States, Operation Paperclip, and building the Saturn series of rockets, which ended up with the Saturn V rocket. But the same design being used for the space shuttle engines, and the other engines since then have used this same basic design, where you have the liquid fuel And as that liquid fuel expands, these tubes wrap around the housing of the engine cone to cool it, and then it's injected. The liquid is turned into gaseous form, is injected into the burning chamber, and that's basically the design of a rocket. And so the Chinese, interestingly enough, go way back with solid rockets. Remember the Chinese sky rockets and what we use for 4th of July, that type of rocket, where there's a hole up through the middle. Basically, it's a cast solid propellant. And once it's lit, you put a fuse up in there. Once it's lit, it burns outwards, a solid fuel rocket. And then you put a stick on it or vanes or whatever, and it'll go up in the sky. And then you can put a second stage where there's a little hole up through the burning chamber and then into a powder keg at the in the top chamber, where it then explodes, and that's we call a skyrocket. Of course, there's many forms of those that you see during 4th of July fireworks or the ballpark or wherever. But at any rate, the Chinese rocketry goes way back. There's a story that there was a Chinese emperor, and he wanted to go into outer space, so he petitioned his rocket craftsman to tie his just hundreds of rockets to his throne, and he had them lighted, and he went up into as far as they could see. He was still going, and never was found again. So, anyway, the Chinese have a long history of using rockets. But now, what happened is the Chinese kind of sat in the wings, and the Russians had their Cosmos project, their basically their space program going on, manned space program, very advanced over what the United States was doing, while we were waiting for the Gemini and the Apollo space program launches to go on. Russia was in space 2 or 3 times a day with manned space programs. But at any rate, and then of course the United States and the alleged moon landing, and then the space program with the various space stations coming up to now. And the Chinese kind of sat in the wings, and about 15 years ago, not much longer, the Chinese decided to go out and get smart about outer space. And so what they did is, back in the post-Reagan days, when the Russian economy was just toast, and their space program was toast, to try and raise money to fund their fledgling space program, the Russians sold technology to China. And this included docking mechanisms. One of the more difficult things to do in outer space is to dock to spacecraft. You would think, oh, that should be easy, but it's not, because of orbital dynamics, going back to the same thing I was talking about at the beginning of this show, that the docking spacecraft in outer space can be relatively difficult. And then getting not only getting them to come together in the correct manner, but to then lock them together and open an air hatch where then people can transfer back and forth between them. A very essential part of any space program that's a manned space program. The Chinese bought all of this off the shelf from Russia. And then they built an actual city. And so, where the United States, for example, has its space development industries all over the place, of course, concentrated in places like Huntsville, Alabama, or Houston, Texas, etc. But the United States has its space facilities spread all over the place. It could be Washington State or Colorado, it could be New Mexico, or it could be some other place. But the Chinese said, oh no, we want a specific area where all of their development goes on. So they moved all of these engineers and their astronauts and their, support facilities and everything that you need for outer space, they put in one area. Actually, a couple areas. There's two major ones. And you can say, well, the United States has Goddard and JPL. It's true, but but it's still not to the level of what the Chinese did, because they brought all of their corporation type of engineering also into these very few areas. And so within a very short amount of time, the Chinese have become dominant in outer space. I'm just going to go through a list here of things that are going on. They have a man to the moon programs. They're claiming that by 2030 they're going to have men on the moon. Additionally, they're inviting international players into this. So foreigners to Chinese interests will be invited to be also at their space station, which is a piece of work on its own. In fact, right now as we're speaking, the Chinese space program or the space platform is in the form of a T, and they're adding a new wing onto it, so to speak, in the terms of a hotel wing, and adding another piece. So now it's going to be in a cross shape, and then eventually it will have a rim around the outside. But the Chinese are very advanced, and the addition going on to their space station is also occurring right now. The idea of inviting foreigners into their space mission is very important, because it's kind of like where the Chinese have gone into third world countries and said, we're going to do a better job of investing into your country than previous, especially the United States, where the United States model going into a third world country is they say either do what we say or else. And whereas the Chinese are going in and offering to assimilate these countries, and the Chinese are succeeding. And so it's really turning a lot of countries over to the Chinese side of the chessboard, let's just put it that way. Okay, the Chinese space station, they're sending up young crew members. This is going on right now also, where they've selected very young people to go up into outer space. And I've said this all along, that the Chinese have the mentality, they have the type of culture that's amenable to a space program. The United States does not. The United States has an economy that's based on profit, and basically greed profit, not just profit, but immense amounts of profit. So anytime the government becomes involved in the United States, big money goes out, and that money flows out, and actually very little of it actually goes to the final project. And so that's the case with the space program. There's a lot of people on the payroll, but not a lot happening. The end result has been going on for decades and decades and decades, and we're not seeing any improvement in the science world. But the Chinese have a plan. They're on to this, and they're going to succeed. Also, the large rockets. The Chinese are now building massive rockets that are just enormous, and they have the technology down to the point that they can launch very heavy payloads. And so once they start building space stations, it's just a matter of time until they have gravitational or space stations with artificial gravity. And kind of like the movie 2001, where they had the big spinning disk and creating artificial gravity. But yeah, the Chinese are on their way, and their space station, the Tianyong, is going to be a very fairly large facility and used for research. Of course, the US-Russia combination space station was used for research, but I think the Chinese have a very different attitude about research. A lot of the US effort was in terms of military research, and I think the Chinese are going to go for humanitarian purposes in outer space. In other words, they're going to build a program that is meant for exploration, not warfare. The Chinese, a number of years ago, tested some ballistic anti-satellite technologies and was very successful because it's very easy to take satellites out in outer space. With it's kind of like having a shotgun in outer space. Just release these like a field of small metal particles moving in the opposite direction in orbit. So the end result is for a low Earth orbit, we're talking about 34,000 miles an hour. So there's no satellite in existence that would withstand this kind of a anti-satellite weapon. So the Chinese have these and could take out our, for example, our military GPS transponders, the satellites. And if so, our military would be absolutely devastated because everything they do is based on GPS and GPS locators. Okay, I'm about out of time here. Just want to remind you that I have a few ways that you can help me out. And remember, this show is commercial free. I don't have sponsors. I don't get government money. I don't have corporations that back me or any of those standard ways or have advertisements every 3 minutes on my show. I don't have that to support me, and so the only support that comes in is when you purchase something from my webpage. And so I have the best water filters on the planet. For those, go to the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com, the whole house water filter, the MR5, and most people get what's known as the best deal. It's a combination of the MR5, which comes with its first set of filter elements, and then an extra set of filter elements, the UV sterilizer, and that comes with two bulbs. It comes with two bulbs and two quart sleeves, so you have about 2 years' worth of use out of that. And if you have a sale of over $300 a purchase, you can get another 5% off by using the coupon code JMCC, JMCC, and that's for any of the water filter products. Just remind you also that I have a book on Amazon right now, and more of my books are going to be placed there as time allows. And the title of that book is The Real History of Man and Earth: Myth, Magic, and Mayhem. It's a very good book, very timely book. And then my web page, all of my previous books, CDs, DVDs are available, and also the link to my Patreon channel. So some people are donating a little bit of money every month, and that keeps things like the bills paid, like any business. So that web page, jmccsci.com. You can also get to the water filter page from that page. And I'm out of time, so I'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.